You're listening live to Right Side Radio with Phil Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right.
You're listening to Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right here on News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. This is Brian Taylor standing in for Phil Williams. Phil is out today and tomorrow, maybe Friday too. He's celebrating his 35th anniversary with his wife, Charlene. So congratulations to them. I hope if y'all are listening, I hope you're having a good trip. And we're going to do our best to hold down the fort here. We've got a lot to talk about today. Of course, I've got Copper here with me as always. She's going to keep it straight. How are you doing today, Copper?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. You getting ready? Last time I was with you, we were talking about getting ready for Thanksgiving. Now Christmas is coming up on us. What are your plans this Christmas?
I might have to run out of town for the wedding of one of my childhood friends.
Before Christmas? They're not having the wedding.
No, Christmas. Right before Christmas. It's the 19th.
Okay. Well, at least it's not during football season. Some people make that mistake. But,
true.
Well, that's great. Is your whole family going to get together for Christmas? Or I think during Thanksgiving, you told me you were just going to do something low-key with your sister in town?
Yeah, we're all over the place. My family's spread across like 4 different states. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, might have to do just a quiet at home again.
Yeah, well, we're spread out over Georgia and Alabama, but we usually try to get together at some point. Yeah. I think maybe we're going to go over to Savannah for a few days to visit my brother over there and celebrate Christmas there before we come back home.
But that sounds nice.
We're looking forward to it. The supply chain crisis is still a little bit scary. My son had his 11th birthday this past Thursday, and I ordered a birthday present for him online almost a week in advance, but I ordered it with I paid a little extra fee to get the 2-day FedEx shipment, overnight shipment or 2-day shipment, and the darn thing still hasn't arrived.
Oh, wow.
So, maybe it was in a ditch in Coleman. I don't know if you've heard about that. FedEx, some FedEx driver apparently ditched 450, 500 packages in a ravine
that.
In Coleman. Not
so
sure
weird.
Whatever came of that. But hopefully we won't be too disrupted by the supply chain issues as we go into Christmas. Because I still have to buy my Christmas presents. Are you done shopping?
No.
You got a lot to do.
I haven't even started.
Well, I'm right there with you, and I suspect a lot of people are. Although a lot of people this year that I've talked to have already begun, and some have finished because they're worried about the supply chain issues. They don't trust the Biden administration to fix it by Christmas. Hard to believe.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we've got a lot to talk about today. We've got three great guests that are going to be joining us during the next 3 hours. First of all, Attorney General Steve Marshall is going to join us here in just a few minutes, actually, to talk with us about his recent victories in the federal courts against the Biden administration's vaccine mandates. We're also going to talk at the top of the 3 o'clock hour. We'll be talking with John Wall, the Alabama Republican Party chairman, who's just back from Washington and wants to give us an update on what a mess things are there and what his take on it is and how the Alabama Party is going to stand up to the Washington bureaucracy and the mess that's going on there. And then during the 4 o'clock hour, we're going to be joined by my friend Eric Johnston, who is a lawyer for the Southeast Law Institute and was one of the authors of Alabama's recent bill that was enacted. I can't remember if it was last year or the year before, but it was one of those bills designed to challenge the decision in Roe v. Wade and overturn Roe v. Wade. And he's going to give us a little bit of his take on the recent Supreme Court arguments and where we expect the court to go with the Dobbs case out of Mississippi, which could result in overturning Roe v. Wade. But before we get there, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that I've been seeing just in the news lately on the truth front. Every time I turn on the news, or every time I go to a website, it looks like the left is just absolutely lying or denying about the facts. The facts don't matter to them. You know, President Biden said he was opposed to vaccine mandates, said there won't be any vaccine mandates. And then he, of course, started using the administrative power of the executive branch in an unprecedented way to implement vaccine mandates across the board, but the facts don't matter. Kyle Rittenhouse shot two white men in self-defense, not black men. It was not an act of callous aggression, but the facts don't matter. The left is still coming unhinged about that case. We see progressive policies that seek to defund the police and reduce criminal penalties for thieves in California, and things that have led to an epidemic of smash-and-grab crime sprees. But the facts don't matter. Even AOC, we'll talk about a little later, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is denying that the smash-and-grab robberies even exist. We've got liberal Supreme Court justices decrying the potential overturning of Roe v. Wade as political gamesmanship in the courts, while at the same time pretending that they don't have a political position in favor of upholding Roe v. Wade. But the facts don't matter. And the hypocrisy doesn't matter to them. Why? Because for the left, lying to achieve their progressive ends is not only okay, it's part of the playbook. It's axiomatic Marxism that the end justifies the means. Morality doesn't matter. Facts don't matter. At the end of the day, the only thing that matters is the attainment of their own sanctimonious policy objectives, the reordering of society according to their own morally relative standards. And the policy must be what we decide, what we dictate. And so they're always right. Therefore, if it takes manipulation, deception, or lying, downright denial of incontrovertible facts staring them in the face, they'll stay the course and continue the manipulation. Continue to manipulate, deceive, lie, and deny. We'll be right back after this with Attorney General Marshall right here on WVNN. You're listening to News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right. This is Brian Taylor standing in for Phil Williams. And on the phone right now, we have Attorney General Steve Marshall on the line. He is, of course, former district attorney of Marshall County. He has a long record of conservative, being a conservative fighter. He was the first district attorney, I believe, to achieve a prosecution or a conviction under the Brody Act. Is that right, Attorney General Marshall?
It is. You're taking me down memory lane a little bit here, Brian.
I am. Well, the abortion debate is back in the headlines, of course, with the recent Dobbs case out of Mississippi before the Supreme Court. So I thought it worthy of mentioning that. But we've got plenty of other things to talk about with you today. At the forefront of the news over the last few months, of course, has been the Biden administration's efforts to do exactly what he said he wasn't going to do, which is to impose all kinds of vaccine mandates across the board using his executive powers. And you've been involved and you've spoken, I believe, on this show and on some other shows about your efforts. And you had a victory yesterday. So what's going on? What did the Attorney General's office accomplish yesterday?
We did. Brian, thanks for bringing up just a little bit of the history of this, where, you know, President Biden said months ago that this was not the role of the federal government. And so when we're evaluating the legitimacy in which this administration believes this is an effort that they should pursue, then we have his own very words that showed that this was not something that was the role of the federal government. And that's what, in fact, courts now have been able to say on three different occasions, because three lawsuits have been filed. The most recent victory we had was this week from the Southern District in Georgia, who ruled the federal contractor mandate stayed so that they could not pursue that. And one of the things I think it's also important, Brian, we know this as lawyers, but I don't know that people recognize this completely, is that when we're able to get a stay so that we can enjoin and stop the enforcement of an action temporarily, one of the factors the court has to consider is the reasonable probability that we will prevail on the merits. Right. And so in each of these cases in which we've gotten a stay, one of the fundamental findings from the court was that they accepted our legal arguments and believed that we would ultimately prevail on the merits in the end. And so we're very pleased what we saw went on in Georgia, but that's been kind of the trend that we've seen here. We had the ability to stop the healthcare mandate in its tracks through an order out of a case we're involved in Louisiana about a week ago. And then before that, our first victory was pushing back against the private employer mandate, where that stay took place, and that case is now consolidated nationally in the Sixth Circuit. So it's been been good victories for us, but it's what we've expected all along because we know this administration has acted not only unlawfully, but contrary to the Constitution.
Well, congratulations on those victories. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see. Are these cases that the administration's likely to take up to the Supreme Court?
You know, I would think so. I think the one that's positioned in the Sixth Circuit right now involving private employers is probably the one that is at least procedurally closest to getting there. But we've seen not exactly a great deal of urgency out of the Department of Justice's pleadings thus far. So we'll see. You know, right now we are pleased to know that we've got the initial victory so that we've seen across the board the suspension of the implementation of vaccine programs from multiple employers across the state of Alabama, including recently as a result of the victory this week. We saw Alabama and Auburn suspend their efforts as federal contractors. And so, you know, we're, again, very confident about where we are, feel very comfortable in the arguments that we can make on appeal. And as you well know, from a lawyer's perspective, it's a lot better to be arguing to preserve your victory than to try to overturn something a judge has done.
Yeah, certainly. And I want to unpack this, the federal contractor mandate for a little bit. I think most people are familiar with the Biden administration's effort to require all employers with more than 100 employees to vaccinate their employees or otherwise allow them to take weekly tests, I think. And that's been put on hold as well. The federal contractor mandate, most people probably don't realize just how widespread that is and why the president chose to do it that way. And you mentioned, of course, Alabama and Auburn. People don't think about our universities being federal contractors, but they are, right?
They are. And in fact, that was one of the linchpins for us in the case. But candidly, Brian, I don't know from your time in state government if you knew that Rehabilitation Services was a federal contractor or the Department of Public Health was a federal contractor. When we first learned about the significance of this case as a result of Alabama and Auburn saying that they had roughly $600 million in federal contracts, we were surprised. That was just not something that I expected or knew. And so the scope of this mandate, as you've described, is obviously far broader than any of us anticipated. And the other thing about this mandate that's unique is that not only would it have applied to those federal contractors, but also would have required some work on those that come into contact with federal employees. So if you worked in a building with a federal contractor, the government was going to require you to have some validation that these other folks who are completely unrelated to the contract likewise were vaccinated. And again, just shows the absolute fallacy of what the administration's done and the arbitrary nature in which they've attempted to enforce it.
And the legislature recently tried to address this too in the special session. The state legislature enacted a bill that would ban employers from imposing a mandate on their employees. And that would have, understandably, businesses were concerned about that because that would have put them in between a rock and a hard place, if you will, between the federal mandate and the state non-mandate, right?
No, it definitely would have created a conflict of law, and I'm sure that's something that would have been litigated. But what we did see the legislature do is pass medical and religious exemptions that, you know, would have applied to most under federal law, but at the same time, you know, we had at least no statute in Alabama that clarified what that meant. And, you know, one thing that we've encouraged throughout was that employers provide a liberal construction to those making the medical and religious exemption requests that were available. We see the legislature adopt that same approach and then obviously put together a form that's now should be available for those if they have to be able to claim it. And one thing I thought was unique that they included in there, and we also, you know, spoke to this before the legislature came back in, is if you had COVID, then is there really a compelling reason for somebody to be vaccinated knowing that they developed natural immunity in a recent past? So, you know, that's also something that's included in that recent enactment of the legislature.
And one thing Phil and I have been watching is what's happening over in Oklahoma. You may be familiar. The attorney general there and the governor have also filed a lawsuit. I believe they filed it yesterday that would seek to protect their or exempt their National Guard from the federal vaccine requirement that the Department of Defense is seeking to impose. The Secretary of Defense recently responded to Oklahoma and said, nope, your National Guard is subject to the Department of Defense regulations. Is that something you're following? Is that something you see Alabama or other states joining in on?
It's actually something we very much are following. In fact, got a copy of the complaint probably about the same time you did yesterday to be able to look and ask our team to be able to review. You know, we've also heard those stories. You know, this is the first action that's been filed by any state that involves kind of that fourth prong of the Biden administration's effort on mandates involving federal employees. And so this is the first challenge we've seen there. You know, there's some unique issues legally that impact whether or not we can move forward with it. But we've had a chance to review it and expect to be talking with other states about what can and can't be done.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how that certainly got some unique unique characteristics, the interplay between the federal active duty folks and the National Guard. I know the governor in Oklahoma has been making a point that he's losing National Guardsmen and has made the point that as long as the National Guard is required to be vaccinated, that's going to weaken his ability to respond to natural disasters, tornadoes, those kinds of things, as it weakens the force that he has. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Congratulations again on your victories. Would love for you to stick around. I know you're on the road. Would love for you to stick around for a bit if you can. Have a couple more questions. If you can't, that's okay too.
Brian, I'm going to have to run to a meeting, but thanks for letting me be on, and we'll come back, okay?
Well, we appreciate it. Thank you, General Marshall, for being on with us, and safe travels. You're listening to WVNN, News Talk 770, and we'll be right back right after this break. Conservative, just plain right. This is Brian Taylor standing in for Phil Williams. If you're just joining us, Phil is on vacation today, tomorrow, and Friday. He's taking his wife Charlene somewhere for their anniversary, 35th wedding anniversary. Phil has a note that he keeps over his computer in his studio that says, it's an honor to have this platform. And so I want to thank Phil for allowing me to share this platform with him today. And we just talked to A.G. Marshall. He had a great victory in federal court yesterday, basically shutting down the Biden administration's federal contractor vaccine mandate. And that's a big deal. People don't realize, as we talked about just a minute ago, people don't realize how sweeping that is to ban federal contractors or to require federal contractors to do anything, especially this vaccine mandate. And the reason is because I think most people don't realize just how many, just how widespread the federal money goes through the contracting process. And so what we've seen is Alabama, the University of Alabama and Auburn University have put their vaccine mandates on hold as a result of this ruling. And they were poised to require the vaccines of their employees because they are technically federal contractors because they receive federal money for certain programs at those universities. And now they've put their programs, their requirements on hold pending the outcome of this case. And so congratulations again to Attorney General Marshall for that outcome and for all of the other states and Republican attorneys general who've been assisting with that. So we were talking before he came on about just the egregiousness with which the left seems to manipulate, lie, and deceive in order to attain their policy objectives. And I can't say it any better than what Governor Stitt of Oklahoma said yesterday. That he had a press conference announcing that Oklahoma was suing the federal government, the Biden administration, over the Department of Defense's mandate that all soldiers be vaccinated. Of course, he doesn't have any control over what the Department of Defense does with active duty folks. But when it comes to the Oklahoma National Guard, Governor Stitt says he's the commander in chief and he's going to decide whether or not the vaccine requirement applies to his folks. And he's decided it doesn't. And so they have now filed a suit challenging the Department of Defense's position, the Secretary of Defense's position, that they have authority to order the state National Guard to submit to the vaccine. And so here's what Governor Stitt had to say.
1 year ago, Joe Biden, as president-elect, told Americans that he would not mandate the COVID vaccine. He said, and I quote, "I don't think it should be mandatory, and I wouldn't demand it to be mandatory." As we all know now, that was a lie. President Biden's administration does not believe in personal responsibilities. President Biden doesn't trust Americans to make decisions for themselves. Luckily, our Constitution does. That's why good. Attorney General John O'Connor and I are fighting back against President Biden's federal overreach every step of the way.
I almost cut him off there. That's Governor Stitt of Oklahoma announcing his lawsuit, also challenging the federal mandates. Of course, that was before Attorney General Marshall's victory in the Southern District of Georgia yesterday. But Governor Stitt has gone one step further and is challenging the Defense Department's attempts to require vaccines of the state National Guard. And so that's going to be a really interesting case. It's unique. It's unlike the other challenges because of the nature of the National Guard, sort of the dual nature of the National Guard serving in both capacities. When the National Guard is in a training capacity, when we, as a member of the National Guard, when we drill on the weekends, we're under the command of the governor. We're under the command of the governor of the state. The governor is the commander in chief. We're in a what we call a Title 32 status. That's lawyer speak for the title of the U.S. Code that governs the National Guard. But that title says that we're in a status under the command of the governor. But we're paid for. National Guard is paid for in that training capacity by the federal government. And so Secretary Austin, the Secretary of Defense, who, by the way, is an Auburn graduate, he has written the governor of Oklahoma and said, no, you're wrong. The Department of Defense regulations apply to National Guard members even when they are in a state status. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the courts, how that pans out. We've talked about that before on this show, but we'll follow that. We'll follow that lawsuit from Governor Stitt, and as you heard, Attorney General Marshall just a moment ago, Alabama. Every state has different laws and rules affecting their National Guard, but you know, the Attorney General said that the state of Alabama is going to be monitoring that, and perhaps, who knows, perhaps we'll see the state of Alabama join in that as well, but. I thought what was really interesting about Governor Stitt's speech is he didn't stop short of calling Biden out on telling a lie when he said during the campaign that he opposed mandates, that there would be no mandates. He didn't say that President Biden changed his mind. He said that President Biden lied from the get-go, and so that's what we've been talking about, is to what extent the left is just willing to say anything or do anything to attain their objectives. They have certain policy objectives, right? That the left thinks they know what's best for us. Progressives think that their ideas are superior. As Dan Bongino said on the show right before we came on, he said that the left or Democrats think, Republicans think Democrats are people with bad ideas. Democrats think Republicans are bad people with ideas. I loved that because it really does capture exactly what the left thinks about us in the way we think. And they don't attack us on our ideas. They don't attack the right on ideas. They attack the right with ad hominem, personal attacks. It's difficult to have a debate with someone on the left because they don't like to debate the they don't like to debate on logical grounds. It's based on emotion. It's based on their view of the world, and so what we end up with is an effort to try to impose their view of the world and to impose their policy objectives in ways that are duplicitous, and you know, we've seen that with We've seen that with the Supreme Court recently. We're going to talk about that a little bit at the in the 4 o'clock hour. So if you have a chance, stay tuned with us. But the oral arguments in the Dobbs case that the Supreme Court just heard, which is the challenge to Roe v. Wade, very controversial case. You may have seen protesters outside the Supreme Court building making their case on one side wanting to uphold Roe v. Wade and on the other side wanting to overturn Roe v. Wade and saying that this is the case to do it. It remains to be seen what the Supreme Court's going to do. But if you just listen to some of the questions that the Supreme Court justices asked during those oral arguments, you'll see what I'm talking about. So stay tuned in 4 o'clock hour. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But this effort, you know, even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Representative AOC, she's denying now these smash and grab robberies even exist. We're seeing them with our own eyes on the news. They're widely reported by the mainstream media. Nobody else is denying that these smash and grab robberies of these luxury high-end stores are going on in cities across the country. But she is. And I couldn't help but think it reminds me of a scene of my favorite legal movie, My Cousin Vinny. If you've never seen My Cousin Vinny, you need to watch it. It's a funny movie. It's based in Alabama. But there's a scene where, first of all, Joe Pesci, who plays Vincent Gambini, who's the defense lawyer, he's defending Ralph Macchio. I can't remember the character's name, but Ralph Macchio plays him. He's defending Ralph Macchio from on murder charges, and the defense's theory is that that his client didn't do it. The defense's theory is that somebody else came into the Sack of Suds store and shot the clerk after his client had already left, and he's got the prosecution's key witness on the stand who supposedly observed this from his window while he was cooking grits for breakfast. And Vincent Gambini, who is a rookie lawyer handling this murder case, has this witness on the stand, and he's trying to prove that there's no way he had enough time to witness everything that he said he could witness. So here's the exchange. Absolutely hilarious.
How do you cook your grits? You like them regular, creamy, or al dente?
Just regular, I guess.
Regular. Instant grits?
No self-respecting Southerner uses instant grits. I take pride in my grits.
So, Mr. Tipton, how could it take you 5 minutes to cook your grits when it takes the entire grit-eating world 20 minutes?
I don't know. I'm a fast cook, I guess.
I'm sorry, I was all the way over here. I couldn't hear you. Did you say you're a fast cook? That's it? Are we to believe that boiling water soaks into a grit faster in your kitchen than on any place on the face of the earth?
I don't know.
Well, perhaps the laws of physics cease to exist on your stove. Were these magic grits? I mean, did you buy them from the same guy who sold Jack his beanstalk beans?
Objection, Your Honor.
Objection sustained.
Are you sure about that 5 minutes?
Ignore the question.
Are you sure about that 5 minutes?
I don't know.
I think you made your point.
Are you sure about that 5 minutes?
I may have been mistaken.
I got no more use for this guy.
One of the greatest scenes in pop culture on in a trial movie. Of course, you never hear the left say I may have been mistaken. AOC is a lot like Mr. Tipton there, the witness. She will sit there and deny the existence of actual facts, even when they're staring at us all in the face. And of course, we saw that in the outcome of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. Two white men were killed, but somehow it was a case about the death of the murder of black victims, and believe it or not, people still believe that. I've actually had friends that still believe that and swear that that's what really happened. So even in the face of reality, liberals have trouble accepting it, but that's part of their agenda. That's their playbook. And we'll be talking more about that with John Wall coming up at the 3 o'clock hour. Stay tuned. You're listening to News Talk, 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. This is Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right. You're listening to News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. This is Right Side Radio, solid conservative, and just plain right. Brian Taylor here, taking the reins from Phil Williams today. Phil is with his wife on an anniversary trip, so blessings to him and Charlene, and hope you have a wonderful trip and a wonderful break. Thank you for letting me share this platform today. Lots going on. We just talked about the Biden vaccine mandates and the victories that Attorney General Steve Marshall, Alabama Attorney General, and other states have recently had. Interestingly, the United States Senate may actually vote today. Let me pull this up. The United States Senate is expected to vote as soon as today to nullify Biden's vaccine mandate for large employers. You know, he put into effect this mandate for all businesses that employ more than 100 employees, an absolutely sweeping use of executive, or I should say administrative power, doing it through OSHA. But if the Republicans are successful getting this through the Senate, that would be at least a symbolic victory. We say symbolic because it's doubtful that the House would pass it, although we don't know. You've got two Democrats in the Senate already breaking ranks and saying they're going to vote with Republicans. That's Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and who was the other one? Senator John Tester of Montana say they're going to vote with Republicans to roll back President Biden's vaccine mandate. So he's under fire from all sides. The courts are ruling against him. Now the Senate is poised to vote against him with two Democrats joining the Republicans. So it'd be interesting to see what will happen there. The Republicans expect the resolution to pass with those 52 votes and with the two Democrats. It's the Congressional Review Act. It was enacted in 1996. It sets up a fast-track process in the Senate that allows the minority party to force a vote on a resolution to disapprove of a federal rule, which is how the Biden administration is trying to impose this vaccine mandate. So keep an eye out for that. Call your senators and make sure they know where you stand on that. Of course, we've got two Republican senators. We know where we know how they're going to vote. They're going to vote against the Biden vaccine mandate. But the courts. Man, the courts are really, everybody's been paying attention to the courts lately, more so than normal. You had the first the Rittenhouse trial last week. That, of course, was a criminal trial in a lower court. But people are paying attention to the judiciary now. You know, the left was screaming after the Rittenhouse trial, screaming about the need to just reform the judiciary. Now you've got Supreme Court justices up in Washington who are saying that they need to rule on cases based on what the impact to the health of the judiciary is. They're sort of weird arguments. We'll talk more about that later on. But Justice Sotomayor had an interesting quote that's worthy of review and examination, especially given the fact that, I mean, the courts are there to call balls and strikes. They look at the law, they interpret the law, and they apply the law. And nowhere in their power are they supposed to be concerned about the political impression that ruling on the law will leave. In fact, they're not supposed to be concerned about outcome really at all. They're supposed to be concerned about process and the law and applying the law, not making the law. But the liberals on the Supreme Court, needless to say, have a different opinion. So we'll talk about that in the next hour. We've got, John Wall is going to be coming up. He is he's the state party, Republican Party chairman. He's been in Washington the last few days and says he has some updates for us. And so we're going to be eager to talk to him and find out what exactly is going on up there. You know, we talked just a minute ago about AOC, Representative Ocasio-Cortez, denying that there's an epidemic of smash and grab crimes. And you know, just in the face of reality, these folks just, they won't admit the facts. But you're starting to see it roll back now a little bit as we get closer to the midterm elections. Jen Psaki basically distanced herself from AOC, said the president does not agree. The president acknowledges the problem with smash and grab crime. So now that we're getting close to the midterms and you're seeing them go down in the polls, we're starting to see some folks in the Democratic Party distancing themselves from the far left. Much more to talk about. Coming up next is John Wall. We'll be right back on Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right.
Bill Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right.
News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. This is Brian Taylor standing in for Phil Williams today. And we are excited to have chairman of the Alabama Republican Party on the line with us, John Wall. John's a small businessman. He's from Limestone County originally. He was elected as chairman of the state Republican Party in March of this year. Is that right, John?
Yeah, end of February.
End of February. All right. Well, you've been in the position long enough now to sort of get a feel for what your role is and what's going on across the country. While you're the state party chairman, you have probably daily contact, if not weekly contact with other party chairmen and members of the National Republican Party. And I understand you just got back from Washington last week.
No, that's right. And you know, it's always a battle when you're fighting in politics, because for me, it's always issues-based. You know, I want the party to be standing up for people's rights, their freedoms, really come from the grassroots side of the party, and try to represent the people of Alabama as best I can, both here in Alabama and on the state party, but also, you know, as a member of the RNC,
Yeah, and so what's going on in Washington?
Pretty much everything bad. So it's a mess up there, you know, and the Democrats really have showed their color since taking control. And I think that's great for the Republican Party headed into 2024.
But
I see that are just crazy right now is government spending. It's just completely out of control. This idea that government can print money at will and just pump it into the economy with no consequences. It's really, really crazy right now on any kind of fiscal sanity.
Yeah, well, we were talking before you called in about even Democrats are now starting to distance themselves from the insanity somewhat. You've got two Democrat senators who now supposedly are going to vote with Republicans against the Biden vaccine mandates. You've got the Biden administration distancing itself from AOC's denial of the smash and grab robberies that are going on. So is that what's going on? Are we seeing the left, or at least the moderates in the Democratic Party, trying to now pull away from the left a little bit as we approach the midterm elections?
You know, I think somewhat, but the crazy thing is not more. So it actually seems like the Democrats have really tightened down and are holding the line. You're not seeing much compromise when it comes to their core agenda. You know, whether that's the move towards socialism, progressive ideas into our education system, or this out of control spending that's going to lead to massive inflation, which is just another tax on the people of America.
Yeah, and I don't think a lot of people realize that inflation is a result of this monetary policy, or modern monetary policy, which is let's just print a bunch of money and try to stimulate the economy, and the result of that is more money the goal is more money for more spending programs, but it's really just a backdoor tax, isn't it?
No, exactly, because it waters down the monetary system. So that's what I always tell people. There's only a finite amount of real money, of actual assets. So it doesn't matter how many dollars you print. When you print more, you don't create more wealth. What you do is you create each dollar is worth a little bit less than it used to be. So when they do these massive spending programs, shoot into the economy, yes, it injects that in right away, but the long-term consequences is less buying power per dollar, and it hurts the consumer. There's a delayed reaction, and the last injection was more directly to people. You know, it's directly to citizens. During the coronavirus, where they were giving out money to taxpayers and to the public. This next round of heavy injection of money is going to be for their pet projects. And it's not going to start in the pockets of the people. And that is completely going to devastate our middle class. And we're going to see inflation hitting 10% next year.
Yeah. And I think I saw a report last week, that maybe came out of the CBO, Congressional Budget Office. But anyway, the president's tax cuts, President Trump's tax cuts actually resulted in the largest benefit to the middle class in modern times. And I haven't seen a whole lot of that in the news. We just see a lot about the efforts by the Democrats to increase spending and the size of government even more.
It's one of those things. It's hard to imagine that people as smart as they should be, and we elect them, they still don't seem to understand that basic concept that money does not grow on trees.
Isn't that true? You know, I was thinking the other day, I am certainly not an economist, but I did take I took Economy 101 in college, and I remember very vividly being taught that printing money causes inflation. And yet, when I open the paper, when I look on the web, and I see even mainstream outlets scratching their heads, wondering, where is inflation coming from?
And, right.
At what point did economists drop this idea? I don't know. Anyway, tell me, what is it that what is your focus as chairman of the party? What do you see that you need to be doing with the Republican Party? Obviously, Alabama is a red state. Of course, we've had a Democratic U.S. senator recently who was defeated by Coach Tuberville. But it's highly unlikely that we're going to be sending a Democrat back to Congress. So as the party chairman, what's your focus? What's your goal?
Well, and obviously our number one target is always winning elections. We're going to be watching every position, national, local, and trying to be competitive everywhere we can be. Yeah, you're absolutely right. On our federal side, we're pretty safe here in Alabama. And that's why it's so important that we do, it's Alabama, we organize, we get our volunteers together, we fundraise, and then my plan is actually to get active in other states. So we'll help, be involved and engaged in helping take back the House and the Senate. So that's very important to me is winning back control for the Republicans. Also, always on a policy side, it's important that the party stand strong for people's values, for their rights, and protect our policies moving forward. Because we're very much in a battle for the heart and the soul of this country right now. And with that, I'll tell you one area that I'm really passionate about is education. Because I think we're really seeing, I'm not even going to call them Democrats, I'm going to call them what they are, which is socialists. We're seeing socialists who want to social engineer our children into their idea of what a good, a good citizen, quote unquote, good citizen should be.
Yep.
So I think it's incredibly important that we know they're targeting our school systems and our education and our children, and that we fight back against that and try to protect our children.
Well, I know that obviously in Alabama, that several years ago there was some leadership on the school choice front, and the Republican legislature passed some reforms that expanded school choice options. There was not much attention in the state legislature to that in the last session, the last regular session. Is that something that you, as the party chairman or the party in general, will be discussing with members of the state legislature and trying to encourage them to prioritize?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and actually, it's almost in the reverse of that. So I've actually been approached by members of the state legislature this cycle saying they are going to make that a push. They would love the party to help on it. And I've already in conversations where, yes, I would love to see us, Alabama this cycle pass some true school choice legislation.
Well, that's great. That's great to hear. And certainly, that's the education. Our schools is where the rubber meets the road. And as I've always said, the quality of your education shouldn't be based on which side of the street you live on or which zip code you live in. If you're not getting a good education, and we have a public education system, you ought to be able to take care of your children and make sure they're getting the best education possible. So, well, that's good to hear that that's a priority for you. What is it that obviously most of the listeners to this program are conservatives, vote Republican? What is it that that folks that have not been involved in the party, what is it that they can do to become more involved in the party?
You know, that's a great question. And we're always working, whether it's on policy, whether it's, you know, volunteers, whether it's donors. You know, we're building as many people, and we'd love to have people, if they're interested in getting involved with us, they can always check us out online, our social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter. Also, our website is algop.org, and we would love to have people reaching out to us if they're interested in volunteering or donating. That we always enjoy building a coalition ready to help take back this country.
And you've got clubs around the state in different cities, different counties. How is that organized?
That's right. So we have county parties in every county in the state, as well as the state party, and then a lot of women's Republican groups, minority GOPs, all around the state. So, yeah, there's something for everyone.
Well, great. Encourage everybody to get involved, whatever your background. There's always an opportunity. But they can find that information on the Alabama GOP website.
That's it, algop.org.
Well, John, thanks for calling in. It's great to hear you. Appreciate what all you're doing, and look forward to seeing more from you in the weeks and months and years ahead. We're going to be back. If you'd like to stick around with me, you're welcome to. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Supreme Court and the efforts to pack the Supreme Court. There was a report out yesterday by the president's commission on the Supreme Court, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then we've got Eric Johnson coming up at the 4 o'clock hour to talk about the Dobbs case that the Supreme Court heard earlier this week. So stay tuned. You're listening to News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. This is Brian Taylor filling in for Phil Williams on Right Side Radio. Solid, conservative, and just plain right. Just plain right. You're listening to Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right. Copper and I are actually in different studios today, and so we're having it's a challenge, but she's doing a great job trying to keep me coming in at the right time and going out at the right time, and it's completely my fault if I'm not doing that. So thank you, Copper, for doing your best to try to keep me on track here. Just keep it up, okay?
Sure, it will do.
All right. We've got John Wall, the Alabama GOP state chairman, on the phone with us, and I wanted to talk to him a little bit about an issue that's not getting a lot of news coverage the last day or so. But yesterday, President Biden's Supreme Court Advisory Commission, let me get the name of this correct. It is the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court. It was an advisory commission that President Biden set up to really, I think when he set it up, it was to kick the can down the road when he was facing problems or controversy regarding the issue of court packing, whether to add more justices to the United States Supreme Court. But that advisory commission issued its report yesterday, and they didn't really have a conclusive recommendation one way or the other. So I guess they're gonna kick the can down the road a little bit more. But progressives obviously want to pack the Roberts Court in hopes that it'll rule in ways that will frustrate their political objectives. So, John, what are you hearing from your colleagues in other states and other state political parties? Other state party organizations and in the national party regarding these efforts by the progressives and the left and the Democratic Party to, when they can't win in the courts, to just turn the table over and change the makeup of the courts?
Well, you know, isn't that just like Democrats? Yes. You know, if you can't win with the rules of the game, what do? You change the rules of the game. And it's just really, it just really rubs me the wrong way. But we are seeing a push in this direction. I love that, that Biden's own commission has not come back with that recommendation, because do not take this ruling as neutral. You know, this their findings as neutral. This is actually a condemning this idea of packing the courts or increasing the size, because that was what they were being pushed to do. And so a report coming back neutral is actually, they're basically saying, look, no, what, why would we change it? So it's actually, it's a victory for us when even the Democrats can't get their own groups to follow their policies.
No, I think that's a great point. In fact, I want to read a, it's a little bit long, but I want to read a paragraph out of this report. Keep in mind, this is President Biden's commission, like you said. And the report says, for opponents of court packing, the United States' fidelity to this norm has particular significance in light of developments in other parts of the world where manipulation of the composition of the judiciary has been a worrying sign of democratic backsliding. After his election in 1989, for example, Argentinian President Carlos Menem worked to draw greater power into the executive branch. And in 1990, he successfully added four new members to a formerly five-member Supreme Court. In 2004, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela reined in judicial independence by expanding the size of the constitutional court in that country from 20 to 32. And in 2010, Turkish leader Erdogan's populist party consolidated control over the Turkish constitutional court by expanding its membership from 10 to 17 and altering the process by which judges were selected. In 2010, the populist Fidesz party won a narrow majority in the Hungarian parliament and quickly went about consolidating power, including through the addition of several new seats to the constitutional court. In 2018, a package of judicial reforms in Poland forced sitting judges off the bench and dramatically expanded the size of the Supreme Court. By contrast, stable democracies since the mid-20th century have retained a strong commitment to judicial independence and have not tended to make such moves. So, I mean, that's insightful, isn't it? We've got all of these socialist countries and places where you don't have stable democracies, and you have the executive trying to centralize and amass his own power, manipulating the court system, manipulating the size of the courts. Is that what Democrats are trying to do here?
And that's exactly what we had here. You know, the Biden administration saw that they wanted to implement new programs, new social programs, and socialists, a truly socialist agenda. And they knew they couldn't do it with the current makeup of the court because the Supreme Court would rule against them. And yes, they went to a changing the size of the court as a way to neutralize the court's power and neutralize our founders' visions of this government where we have a check and balance system where the courts would be a check on the power of the executive branch. So, no, absolutely. I feel like this commission's finding is actually a very, very much a condemnation of the Biden administration.
Well, it's embarrassing almost to have that paragraph in the report comparing what you're trying to do to a bunch of socialist countries. But you know that they almost don't even try to hide it anymore. And that's where it becomes so important for people like you and for the party to stand up and make sure that that the grassroots out there are informed and know what their government is doing. So, John, thank you for joining us and for everything you're doing on that front to keep everyone informed and involved, and to be a resource, both a resource and a guide for our elected officials. So hope you'll come back and join us again soon.
It was an honor. I'll look forward to it.
All right. Thank you. Well, you're listening to News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, Right Side Radio. I'm Brian Taylor filling in for Phil Williams. He's on an anniversary trip. We'll be back in the second half of this hour to talk more about court packing and the Biden administration's efforts to manipulate the court system. Listening to Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. This is Brian Taylor. I'm sitting in for Phil Williams today. He's on an anniversary trip with his wife, Charlene. We've had John Wall. We've had some pretty good guests on today. We had Attorney General Steve Marshall in the first hour talking a little bit about his fight against the Biden vaccine mandates. The AG, the Alabama AG, won a case yesterday in the Southern District of Georgia that put on ice President Biden's effort to require federal contractors to receive the vaccine for their employees to be vaccinated. And so now there are on three different fronts, the Biden vaccine mandates have been enjoined, at least for now. You've got the mandate that was imposed on federal contractors to have their employees vaccinated, the mandate that was required of all businesses, private businesses that employed more than 100 people, that's put on ice too. And so just not a good week, not a good run of events for the Biden administration. Of course, that's what happens when you flagrantly try to violate the law and the Constitution. And that's what the courts are for. And we've been talking a little bit about, we just talked to John Wall, the Alabama party chair, about what the Democrats are trying to do with packing the courts. That's an issue we haven't talked about in a while. But just yesterday, the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court issued its report back to the president. You may recall this was a commission that Biden set up to advise him on how to, quote, improve or reform the court system, including the controversial issue of court packing. The commission actually did reach a decision on that. They didn't make a recommendation. In fact, the report says the commissioners themselves were strongly divided over the question of whether more seats should be added to the Supreme Court. And here's how this works. I mean, the Supreme Court exists as a constitutional creature. Of course, the judiciary is set up by the U.S. Constitution, but Congress has the authority to add and subtract the members of that court, essentially the number of justices that sit on that court. And so that's what the debate has been about, is whether or not the Congress should do that. There clearly is a strong majority of the Democratic Party would like to do that. And the reason they want to do it is because they can't win in the courts. What they're trying to do is, in many cases, is outside the bounds of the law. And I was listening to the oral arguments in the Dobbs case. The Dobbs case is the case out of Mississippi that the court heard a few days ago, took oral arguments on, that may reverse or overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark decision that upheld or created this notion that there is a constitutional right to an abortion. Of course, there's not. The Constitution is silent on that. But Roe v. Wade determined that there would be. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the ins and outs of that case and this challenge in the 4 o'clock hour with Eric Johnston, who is a lawyer and runs the Southeast Alabama Law Institute. Excuse me, the Southeast Law Institute, based here in Alabama. And he's had some experience in drafting some of this legislation that's designed to overturn Roe v. Wade, and he's following these issues. So if they're of interest to you, you'll definitely want to tune in to hear Eric at 4 o'clock. But before we get there, I want to just play one clip by Justice Sotomayor from these oral arguments this week. It's astonishing to me. Keep in mind as you listen to this clip what conservatives believe the role of the judiciary really is, and that's to interpret and apply the law as it's passed by Congress and signed by the president. Here's what Justice Sotomayor's primary concern is as the court determines whether or not to wade into overturning Roe v. Wade in the Dobbs case.
Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts? I don't see how it is possible. It's what
I'll tell you how it's not possible when members of the court from the bench are declaring an issue to be a political issue that the court therefore should not touch because it has strong feelings in the population, strong feelings on either side. When she says from the bench that any decision this court makes to review its prior decision in Roe v. Wade is a political decision. She is the one politicizing it. There's no doubt about it, and that's what she's trying to do. This wasn't an accident. This was deliberate. She's saying from the bench that if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, it will be viewed by the population as a political decision done by a bunch of conservatives on the court, and therefore the court should not do it. Never mind what the law says. Never mind what the Constitution says. She doesn't believe that judges are capable of a fair and impartial reading of the law and application of the law. She wanted to make it very clear. She announced from the bench that any decision that went counter to what she would decide is therefore a political decision, as if she doesn't herself have a political position on the issue. It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd that a judge would from the bench question the impact, the political impact of the outcome of a decision, when the court's job is to take the law and the facts before it and review whether or not it's consistent with the Constitution. And obviously she would be very upset if the court were to overturn Roe v. Wade. And the reason she would be upset is because she's unapologetically pro-choice. That's no secret. That's her right to have that opinion. But as judges, I was baffled to hear both her and Breyer from the bench making this issue about whether or not a reversal or an overturning of Roe v. Wade was basically a threat to the existence of the Supreme Court, or a threat to the reputation of the judiciary. The Supreme Court, throughout its history, has ruled on highly controversial political issues. It's no secret. I mean, Justice Breyer at some point during the oral arguments said something to the effect of, "Hey, this Roe v. Wade's a watershed decision. It's been the law, quote the law, for over 50 years, and this court therefore shouldn't touch it because it's been on the books for 50 years. We've all been living with Roe. That's what we've all been operating under for 50 years, so we shouldn't touch Roe v. Wade." Well, if that's the standard, if that's the logic, you want to follow that logic to its end, then what do they think about Brown versus Board of Education? If you remember, if you know anything about Brown versus Board, it overturned the principle that had been in effect for 50 years that upheld separate but equal schools. Brown v. Board of Education was a landmark decision of itself, precisely because it overruled a bad decision over 50 years earlier, Plessy versus Ferguson, where the court upheld the policy of separate but equal. And so, you know, where were these liberal justices in 1970? I don't remember exactly when Roe v. Wade was decided, but you didn't hear anybody then saying we can't decide the case. We can't find a right to abortion, a federal right to abortion in the federal constitution, because that would upset 200 years of jurisprudence, 200 years of state regulation of abortion. I mean, Roe v. Wade was an absolute overturning of 200 years of precedent. And so for them to come out now and say that it would be somehow political, that it would be unsustainable for the courts to adopt a new position, reversing or overturning Roe v. Wade, it just doesn't make logical sense. The court has done that a number of times in its history. Most well known is the Brown versus Board of decision, the Brown versus Board decision declaring that separate but equal was not correct, and that separate schools were necessarily unequal. But Brown v. Board is rightfully celebrated as a landmark decision, precisely for overturning a bad decision 50 years earlier. So maybe the judges will, they're not going to change their mind. We know where everybody stands on this issue because Justice Sotomayor admitted it from the bench when she declared that it was a political case. She basically declared that she had a political position. and she wasn't going to vote counter to that political position, no matter what the evidence in the case or no matter what the law turned out to be. So that's what we've come to expect from liberals on the judiciary. President Biden had asked this commission to give him advice, recommendations on whether or not the Congress should increase the number of judges on the Supreme Court, because they can't win with the court that they have. So they figure they're just going to remake the court. That's dangerous, ladies and gentlemen. That's dangerous. I mean, imagine what that leads to. Does that mean every time that a new president is elected and appoints new justices, we're going to have a remaking of the court? That's exactly what the left wants. They want nothing short of the ability to manipulate the outcome of cases to achieve and attain their political and policy objectives, because they think they know what's right and what's best for the rest of the world. I said it earlier on the show, Dan Bongino and his show before this, he said, Republicans think Democrats are people with bad ideas, and Democrats think Republicans are bad people with ideas. And that sums it up. They will stop at nothing. The end justifies the means. There's nothing that is out of bounds for attaining those political objectives. And so we need to be watching what's happening in our courts, what kinds of judges are being nominated. I heard earlier today the nominee for comptroller has withdrawn from she grew up in the Soviet Union. Republicans have been accusing her of being a communist. She was Biden's nominee to run around our money system and oversee the free markets, and Republicans have successfully gotten her to withdraw her nomination because obviously we can't have somebody with a communist background overseeing our financial markets and our economic system. So, you know, we've got victories here and there. Attorney General Marshall has accomplished success yesterday in Georgia with putting Biden's vaccine mandates on ice, and it's going to take strong conservatives across the country doing things like that, standing up and calling out the left for their nonsense, and making the case for conservative values and principles that this country was founded on. This country was built on. Progressives, by their nature, want to toss those out. They're going to use the court system. They're going to use the administrative bureaucracy. They're going to do whatever they can to attack everything that made this country great. And that's the way I see it. Would love to have your calls. Feel free to call in. The number is 1-866-494-WVNN. That's 1-866-494-9866. We'll be back right after this with Eric Johnston from the Southeast Law Institute on News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right. You're listening to News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. This is Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right. Brian Taylor sitting in for Phil Williams today. Phil is on an anniversary trip with his wife, Charlene. So I hope you guys are having a great trip. I hope you're not listening to the show right now, actually. But Phil, I miss you when you're gone. this is hard doing a three-hour show, folks. There's a lot to talk about. There's always a lot going on in the news, but it takes a lot to get ready for a show like this and to line up guests and to be prepared to talk on these subjects. So we're doing the best that we can, but Phil's done a great job. He's pretty new to the format as well. And, of course, there's a lot of folks out there, a lot of folks in Alabama. Jeff Poor down in Mobile does a great job on his show. I was looking at this news story just came in, and I said, "What is this?" The a boat has been a boat in a Christmas parade with the message "Let's go Brandon" on it has been disqualified after winning the first place prize. The boat was awarded first place at the annual Yorktown Lighted Boat Parade in Virginia. But hours later, the Yorktown Foundation, the nonprofit organization that sponsors the parade, announced that the boat had been disqualified and stripped of its award over its overt political message. The event organizers immediately notified the judges that the boat would be disqualified because of its political statements. They were at odds with the mission of the foundation, and the second place boat would be advanced to the winning position. So if you're in a Christmas parade, be careful about offending the censors. You don't want to put "Let's go Brandon" on your boat. You might get disqualified. That reminds me of another story I saw this morning. The European Union recently withdrew some guidelines that sparked anger, including from the Vatican. They issued some guidelines for woke language. You know, we use the word woke now. It's always been around. It used to be called politically correct. Now we refer to it as woke. At least they're close. But French President Macron has said that he does not adhere to Eurocrats explaining the words people can and can't use. This comes just a week after Brussels withdrew its controversial guidelines for inclusive communication. Let's see. They wanted to stop using the word Christmas across the European Union and instead use the phrase holiday period because Christmas is offensive to non-Christians. So EU, we've been through that. We've been through some of that here. Let's see. What else did I see? They wanted to change the word. What was this? Well, I've lost it now. I'm sorry. It was just it was a slew of just ridiculously politically correct terminology that they were advising needed to be changed through the EU bureaucracy. Oh, here they are. The word stewardess needed to be changed to flight attendant, and principal needed to be changed to headmaster. Excuse me, the word principal instead of headmaster or headmistress. I mean, those aren't too egregious. We've already kind of gone down that path here. There was one. I'll fight it here in a minute. I'll fight it here in a minute at the next break. It was absolutely hilarious to see what the EU is putting out. And kind of funny to see the French president being the one to slam them. All right. Well, we'll be up next. If you want to call in, I tell you what, we're going to come up next with Eric Johnston of the Southeast Law Institute. Eric is a great lawyer. He's been on the forefront of the pro-life battle, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about what's going on in the Supreme Court and overturning Roe v. Wade. So stick around for that. We'll be right back with Eric Johnston, and then I'd like to hear your calls in response, and we'll do that at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right. This is Brian Taylor. Stay tuned. Eric Johnston's on the way.
You're listening live to Right Side Radio with Phil Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right.
You're listening to News Talk, 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. This is Brian Taylor standing in for Phil Williams. We've been focusing today on the judiciary for a large part of the show and the efforts of the left and progressives to try to manipulate the judiciary by court packing and trying to intimidate justices into being into reaching decisions that are political in nature rather than calling balls and strikes and applying the law as they see it. So those are the methods that we've been talking about that are common to the left. Right now on the show, on the line, I've got Eric Johnston. Eric is somebody I've known for a while and have worked with. When I was in the state legislature, Eric was constantly available as a resource for religious liberties issues. He is the president of the Southeast Law Institute. He is a practicing attorney. And he is also the president of the Alabama Pro-Life Coalition. He works on constitutional issues like religious liberty and sanctity of life. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've obviously had the biggest case to come to the Supreme Court on the abortion debate in decades. A few days ago, the court heard oral arguments in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. And I was hoping you could sort of unpack that case for our listeners and kind of explain. Why don't we do this? Can you give us a primer on what exactly Roe v. Wade decided? What was Roe v. Wade about back in the 70s?
Okay. Roe was a decision that legalized abortion. The basis of it is the unborn child was not a person entitled to protection under the U.S. Constitution. Therefore, you know, the law did not apply, and so women would have a right to do an abortion. Originally, it said the states could have some regulatory authority over abortion, but it was not really unclear, so there were a lot of cases that came after that. We got up in 1992 to Planned Parenthood versus Casey case that reaffirmed Roe and made it, gave us a little bit different view on it. But those are the two main cases over the years that have been what we've been struggling to overcome. And it's I heard your comments just now about packing the court and the judiciary and that kind of thing. You know, since the 1940s, constitutional jurisprudence and lawyers have struggled with liberal courts. And finally, when we get a court that's really objective and wants to interpret the Constitution, the other side says there's something wrong with it. They've just gotten accustomed to the U.S. Supreme Court being another political arm of the government, which has been incorrect. And then Roe was one of the worst decisions that ever came out of the court during all those decades.
Yeah, and I, you know, obviously as a lawyer, I have some basic understanding. I took constitutional law in law school, but I'm not a constitutional attorney. You are. And so what was it going back to the Roe v. Wade decision? To the best of my recollection, that Roe v. Wade set up this trimester separation where the states did not have the authority to restrict or regulate abortion within the first trimester. And that was later changed in the Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision, which I think dispensed with the trimester regime and replaced it with this viability doctrine that states could not regulate or restrict abortions during the period of non-viability. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's essentially correct. The trimester concept was something that the Supreme Court came up with in 73, which didn't make any sense. It was not part of medicine.
Did they just invent that out of whole cloth?
Not part of law. It was sort of arbitrary, just like the opinion was arbitrary. If you read, you know, they didn't have emails back then. I guess they did memos. Between Douglas and Blackmun and Brennan and the other liberal justices, they were basically saying, where's this right to abortion in the Constitution? I can't find it. And they bounced ideas off of each other about what it would be. And they came up with this idea of the penumbras, the shadowy part of the Constitution where nothing is really spelled out, but there are rights hiding in there. And so they shined some light in there, and they found this abortion right. And ultimately, it became the viability standard in the And basically, the court said, when the child can live outside the womb, after that, the state can prohibit abortion. Other regulations may be permissible as long as it does not unduly burden the woman's right to get the abortion. So right now, what we're really struggling with in the whole central issue in Dobbs, well, it's not really, Dobbs affects viability, but it's not the ultimate question. The ultimate question is, how is the court going to treat the viability standard?
All right. So in the Dobbs case that the court is now taking up, that this is over. This is a challenge, basically setting up a challenge to Roe v. Wade. As I understand it, the law provides that the state can regulate abortions or restrict abortions or outlaw. It's directly outlaws abortions beyond 15 weeks. Is that?
That's correct. It's a heartbeat kind of bill.
Okay.
It had been around for several years, and you get variations on that time, and it's like medical science develops over time. We get more and more information. So you know, you can pretty well get that heartbeat down to maybe 6 weeks, and that's kind of what that Texas law does. The 15-week, though, really is kind of an arbitrary number. If you stop and think about it, it's below viability, which is 20 weeks with a 4-week margin of error, so you usually say 24 weeks. So 15 weeks, what's that really got to do with? That's below viability. If you're going to say you can regulate things below viability, why not go on down lower? You know, Chief Justice Roberts asked a question during the oral argument about 15 weeks. He said, is 15 weeks not long enough to make up your mind whether you want to have an abortion or not?
Yeah.
That kind of gives you an idea. He's not thinking about the viability standard so much as he is thinking about some, you know, middle-of-the-road decision, which, is, you know, he's good for doing that, trying to find a consensus and not going so far. But I think the biggest problem in the Dobbs case in the Mississippi law is that it goes to 15 weeks, but it does not answer the ultimate question of what you do about Roe v. Wade.
Well, do you expect that certainly there were some justices during the oral arguments that indicated, I think Justice Kavanaugh basically asked questions about why should we not return to an era of neutrality from the federal bench and the perspective of the federal constitution and let the states restrict abortion on a state by state basis. So do they have the votes?
Well, I think there's going to be enough votes to do something with it. I mean, I don't think Roe and Casey are going to be standing the same way when this is over. And I don't know if Kavanaugh was kind of fishing for some information there from the lawyers or from the other justices on, you know, where's the effect that abortion is not in the U.S. Constitution, so why are we dealing with it, in essence, is what he was saying. But, you know, prior to Roe, it was sort of an unspoken thing. It was not really an issue that unborn children were protected. We didn't have abortion. Most states had laws against abortion, one degree or another.
Right.
Some states had begun to pass laws to permit abortion, like New York and some others, for Roe. But if not, you know, if you kick it back to the states, you're going to have kind of a potpourri of different things. You know, some states are going to permit it throughout the entire pregnancy, some don't. What we try to do with the Alabama bill that we got passed in 2019, is to say life begins basically from conception. Our law didn't say conception because you can't prove conception. And we wrote our statute as a criminal statute, treating the unborn child as a person. So if you murder an unborn child in the womb, you're guilty of a Class A felony, which is capital murder. And we were asked at the time, well, that's pretty severe for, you know, doing an abortion. I said, well, if you're going to be consistent with the personhood concept, then you got to treat that kid that's in the womb the same as you would treat me and you walking around people as being protected, as people being protected. If you kill one of us, it's murder. And so to do that, we took out of our criminal code, and I don't want to give you too much detail, I get too confused with it, the definition of a person, and the definition of a person in the Alabama Criminal Code is if the fertilized egg is implanted in the uterine wall and then you take the life of that developing child, then you're guilty crime, except for abortion. Abortion is an exception. You know, we're seeing in the media these days Scott Peterson's, you know, re-sentencing. He's going to keep the death penalty because he killed his wife and unborn child out in San Francisco years ago. When that happened, Alabama did not have a law that protected unborn children from murder. And so we amended the criminal code to get away from the old common law definition of having to be born and alive before you can have a crime committed against you, and came up with the definition of the implanted fertilized egg. We used that same definition in our abortion prohibition law so that the DA could prove there's a person there, he could prove that a life was taken. And that's all consistent with personhood. And going back to what I'm saying, what we wanted to do is show by medical evidence, ultrasound, fetal photography, pain-capable heartbeat, all these factors demonstrate the unborn child is a person. If we could get the U.S. Supreme Court to agree with that and say, yeah, the unborn child is a person within the meaning of the Constitution, then no state could pass a law that would allow abortion. Now, maybe that's a bridge too far, but, I mean, that is, I think, you know, best and purest way to approach this. The Mississippi law does not really do that, so it's going to mean more litigation is going to follow after it.
Yeah, so that's my question. Let's assume the court reaches a compromise or middle ground here. Maybe they uphold the Mississippi law, but they don't explicitly overturn Roe v. Wade. They just adjust it a little bit, somewhat like they did in Planned Parenthood. Isn't that just going to lead to more and more efforts to, you know, push it back until we get to the point of conception?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's where it's got to go to. You know, Brian is a practicing lawyer. You know, judges, particularly appellate court judges, they don't rule on any more than what's before them. And there's even rules that if you don't bring up something in the trial court, you can't bring it up on appeal later.
Right.
So they only have the Mississippi law in front of them. They only have 15 weeks in front of them. I doubt very seriously that they'll do anything that's really drastic. But having said that, there's another rule that we lawyers follow, and that is you don't try to predict what your judges are going to do.
That's right. Well, so I want to talk to you about a couple of you may have been listening earlier when I was talking about some of the questions from the bench that made me recoil somewhat, and would like to just pose those to you, see what your thoughts are about them. If you can hold on with me throughout the break, we'd love to keep tapping your brain on this.
Okay.
All right. Well, we will be right back after this. We're going to ask Eric to give us his thoughts on some questions the judges asked in the Dobbs case. Keep listening. You're listening to Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. This is Brian Taylor. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. I'm Brian Taylor, sitting in for Phil Williams today. He's on an anniversary trip with his wife, Charlene. And we've got Eric Johnston on the line right now. Eric's been talking with us about the reform efforts to get some legislation up to the Supreme Court that would set up an opportunity to overturn Roe v. Wade. And of course, the court recently took up a case out of Mississippi, the Dobbs case, and they heard oral arguments on that just a few days ago. What I wanted to do, Eric, is if I could, you've given us a great background of sort of what's going on the state legislative front and the judicial background. But I had some specific questions for you about some of the questions that were brought up during the case, during the oral arguments a few days ago. So, Copper, if you play that clip from Justice Sotomayor real quick, I want to revisit that.
Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts? I don't see how it is possible. It's what...
So, Eric, there you have a sitting justice of the Supreme Court from the bench essentially labeling a possible overturning of Roe v. Wade as creating a stench in the public perception. And so do you think, was that an appropriate question? And maybe it was. I know there's some precedent out there that they've got to work through regarding when it's appropriate for the court to abandon its policy of stare decisis, which is a funny Latin word for maintaining a precedent. But what do you think about that quote? We've lost Eric.
I heard
now?
Her say that. Is it's not the stench of politics on the Supreme Court. What we have is the stench of the millions of unborn children's bodies who have been aborted. If she had thought about what she was saying, she probably would not have said it. But she's the kind of justice that we've had to work with through all these decades, who views everything as political. Obviously,
Eric, thanks. We got to take a hard break. If you want to stick around, we'll talk to you in just a minute. Brian Taylor on Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. You're listening to Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. This is Brian Taylor filling in for Phil Williams. We've still got Eric Johnston on the line with us. Eric, again, is the president of the Southeast Law Institute and also the president of the coalition. Eric, the president of Pro-Life, Alabama Pro-Life Coalition. And Eric works on constitutional issues like religious liberty, sanctity of life. And he's been a mainstay in Montgomery and in the courts championing the cause, the pro-life cause. So, Eric, we were just talking about some of the questions that came from the bench during the recent oral arguments in the Dobbs case. And one of those questions from Sotomayor was this. Will this, and she was asking this of the Solicitor General for Mississippi, who was defending the Mississippi law that creates more restrictions on abortion up to 15 weeks. And she said, will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts? She went on to say, some what are said decisions like Brown versus Board of Education and this one, meaning Roe v. Wade, have such an entrenched set of expectations in our society that this is what the court decided. This is what we will follow. This is the law that we won't be able to survive. We, the court, won't be able to survive if people believe that everything is political. I'm paraphrasing what she said here. She starts naming cases, but then she says there are many political people who believe the court erred in seeing this as a personal right, as opposed to a militia right, talking about the Second Amendment. She says, if people actually believe that it's all political, how will we survive? How will the court survive? So she's almost posing this as an existential threat to the existence of the Supreme Court if somehow the court revisits its decision in Roe v. Wade. What are your thoughts about that line of questioning?
I think that by doing that, she politicizes the argument along with the Democrats, particularly it's a number of well-known senators who had threatened the U.S. Supreme Court, saying, if you reverse Roe, then we're going to redo you and, pack the court, increase the numbers on the court, whatever they could do. I think they politicized the court for a very long time. And as I said when we first started the conversation, we worked through all the decades of politics, and we finally get to the place where the justices are interpreting the Constitution strictly rather than expanding it to cover whatever they think it ought to cover. They don't like that. And so she makes these comments, and they really are political comments. And as I was saying earlier, when she said that, my first thought is it's not the stench. Politics is the stench of the deaths of the unborn children, the millions of children who have died as a result of a faulty court decision. And contrary to what the abortion clinic was arguing in the case, there's nothing in the Constitution about abortion. Kavanaugh pointed that out. There is the question of personhood, and Roe v. Wade clearly said the unborn child is not a person. So we're talking about personhood. Blackmun said in that opinion, words to the effect, that we're not able to determine from medical science when life begins. And then he went on, and I'm paraphrasing him, he said, when we're able to do that, then we can answer this question. In 48 years, we have developed a lot of science that determines and you can determine the actual personhood of the child. And unlike what Justice Kagan said in the court in the oral arguments, she said science hadn't changed much since Roe. She doesn't read the science. She doesn't apparently read the newspaper.
No kidding.
A lot of things have changed. And so it's not political. The correcting an error. Roe opinion has remained the most debated Supreme Court case ever. For 48 years, the issue has done nothing but intensified. The racial cases from the 50s, those were cleared up by the 60s. I'm not saying that racism doesn't exist. It does. But we passed a lot of laws, Civil Rights Act of 1964, to take care of it. When Dred Scott was done in 1856, within 10 years we'd had a civil war and the 14th Amendment was passed. Those issues were addressed. This issue, though, has gone on and on and on with intensity, and it's not political. It's a factual, legal-based issue.
Well, and you mentioned how long it's been on the books. That was an issue that Breyer raised. They all touched on it, but Breyer specifically said, "Hey, this is it. That Roe v. Wade is a watershed decision, and it's been on the books for 50 years. It's been the quote the law for 50 years." So earlier in the show today, I said, well, Plessy versus Ferguson was the law for 50 years, too, before the court issued Brown versus issued its decision in Brown versus Board of Education, overturning 50 years of precedent saying that separate of the policy of separate but equal. And the court was right to do so in that case. I don't know anybody, very many people that say the court was wrong to reach that conclusion. But what level of deference does the court really owe to this decision simply because it's been on the books for 50 years?
Well, I don't think it owes it a lot of deference because it's time. I mean, time doesn't change the reality of what they did. And, you know, and Plessy v. Ferguson and Roe v. Wade both deal with your rights and liberties under the Constitution. They deal with a person's rights and liberties. And that's why neither one of those cases ever died. They remained there debatable because they were wrong. So, you know, I think the Supreme Court has the obligation now to correct that. The Supreme Court reverses itself all the time. It's just that most of the cases are not all that big, you know, they're not that important, and they don't affect a lot of people. And so they change a precedent, and it's not a big deal. But when it's a big case like this and a big issue like this, then obviously it gets a lot more attention. And then the people who don't want it reversed raise the stare decisis issue, saying, well, it's precedent, we can't reverse it. You know, O'Connor argued the same thing in Planned Parenthood v. Casey. And they ended up with a plurality decision, meaning that was not a full court majority opinion in Casey in 1992, which reaffirmed Roe. I mean, it was a plurality. They couldn't get a majority to agree. And so, you know, this issue is still as strong now as it ever was. It's not a political issue. The Democrats don't want to politicize it because that serves their purpose. And yeah, we don't want to politicize it. We just want to protect, people.
Yeah, and to reiterate your point, the mere questioning from the bench, Sotomayor's question, will this politicization of the issue threaten the very existence of this court? Was in itself, as you just said, was in itself a politicization of the issue. She was declaring, she was basically giving the media talking points, wasn't she? I mean, isn't that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She was giving ammunition to Chuck Schumer and to Senator Whitehouse. They've been the ones that have been threatening the Supreme Court. Gives them something to go and, you know, and introduce bills in the Congress to change the court.
Yeah, well, who knows if they're going to have much success there. There seems to be some of the moderates in the Democratic Party seem to be trying to distance themselves, at least from the extremists like AOC. But I don't know if they're bold enough or courageous enough to do that. We'll see. Well, how long? When can we expect to see a ruling in this case?
It'll be in June next year. It'll probably be toward the end of the month. Big opinions are usually not released until right at the end of June. So, you know, that's when we can expect it. And they probably won't grant review of any other abortion cases like this until after then. So we're going to have to wait and see what happens with this. And that reminds me of something that the listeners may be interested in and want to hear is, you know, this Texas law that's gotten some opinion, recognition, and it went to the Supreme Court. Let me see, I'm looking at my calendar. June next year, June 30th is on Thursday. That's probably the day you expect to see an opinion in the Dobbs case. But that Texas case lowers the rate way below viability, way below the Mississippi case, but it's got a unique issue in it, and that is it's only enforceable by citizens, not by the government, so it's not state action. So the idea is you can stop abortions by taking private action by citizens, and it doesn't violate the Constitution. And so the issue there is the legal thing called standing. You've got to have an actual injury that you can prove in order to bring a lawsuit. That Texas law does not have standing. And what it does is it creates a cause of action where anybody can file a lawsuit, whether they're injured or not. And, I mean, that's a trial lawyer's dream. I mean, that's another whole big issue. If the Supreme Court of the United States decides that you don't have to have standing to file a lawsuit, then you can be sued by anybody for anything. They don't have to prove that they've been hurt. So that's a really important issue, and I think that's a very misguided law, and we actually have had one pre-filed in Alabama here that it's weaker than the Alabama statute that we passed, and it's so it conflicts with it, really. But it creates another problem, and I think the sponsors of that bill ought to wait until Dobbs has decided and wait until the Supreme Court rules on that Texas statute. Otherwise, we're just going to have a lot of confusion and waste a lot of time in the legislative process.
Okay, if the Supreme Court rules, in Dobbs, if they overturn Roe v. Wade, if it's an unqualified overturning of Roe v. Wade, what does that mean for the state of the law here in Alabama?
Well, if it does that, then Alabama's law, though, I think the Attorney General would file a motion in whatever court our statute is in at the time. Right now it's in the District Federal Court. It could be in the 11th Circuit by then. File a motion to say that the law has changed, that Roe v. Wade is no longer the law, and this statute is constitutional, the case be dismissed, and you begin enforcing the law.
All right. Well, thank you, Eric, for the recap and the analysis, and we will certainly stay in touch with you. If I'm back on, if Phil will let me come back and guest host the show sometime, I'd love to have you back on. So take care and keep us posted, all right?
I will. Thank you very much, and you have a Merry Christmas. Thank you.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you, too. Well, Copper, I know that you've been involved. Phil was telling me a little bit about your involvement. You are active in pro-life advocacy here locally, and you have a show on Sunday. What is it that you do on Sundays?
That's right. Yeah, it's called Prayers for Life. It's a hour-long show about top pro-life news of the week, top abortion news. I try and do both local and broader, more national. And then we always end with a prayer that I encourage our listeners to pray that week so that they take some specific action.
Well, that's great. So what are some things that people can do locally? And what are you involved in locally here on this front?
So just recently, I helped organize a prayer vigil outside the abortion center, which took place the day before the Dobbs hearing and the day of. And there's also a lot of other ways you can get involved besides that. There will be another prayer vigil in the spring if you want to do that. But there's a group called Embrace Grace that encourages just general people, locals, to invite single mothers into their church and start a support group at their church. And this organization has done like all of the grunt work that you need to, you know, hand out flowers and stuff and get in touch with people. So a lot of things like that. And the local pregnancy centers, of course, dinner.
What is a pregnancy center? I'm familiar with that, but describe to the listeners, what are we talking about when we talk about a pregnancy center?
Sure. So it's usually a group of volunteers who have created a place where women can come in and get free pregnancy tests, ultrasounds, counseling. They're usually not licensed counselors, but it's just somebody to sit down and talk to them and ask them what they need. And if they can help, they often have little boutiques where they hand out baby clothes, vitamins, can help them get signed up for Medicaid, and so many different ways to make motherhood actually a realistic choice for these parents.
And do they see the results of the ultrasound when they come in and get a free ultrasound?
They do. Yeah.
Have you ever seen anybody change their mind, make a decision not to abort a child?
I have not. I'm not usually, I'm not actively engaged with them during the day because, you know, I'm here. But
I'm working.
But yeah, they've seen quite a lot of people. I believe their number so far since January of this year was 88 individuals who chose life instead of aborting.
Did you happen to listen to any of the oral arguments in this case at all?
I did. Yeah.
What did you think?
Oh, well, I was surprised by how much they were talking about precedent being the issue at play. And I guess I didn't realize how significant Casey was as a previous case that then upheld Roe, and how basically it's double whammy that we're trying to overturn here.
Yeah, Planned Parenthood v. Casey sort of spent a lot of time setting out the reasons or setting out a legal framework for when it is appropriate to overrule a precedent and when it's not. And so I think a lot of the discussion in the oral arguments here was less about the substance of Roe v. Wade itself and more about whether we should just accept it again, like Eric and I were just talking about, because it's been on the books for 50 years.
Yeah, that probably surprised a lot of people who were expecting more of a discussion about redefining when a child is a human life. And it's really more about this state and the federal rights at play here.
Well, it's a lot. It's a lot to unpack, and I hope that we'll continue to talk about it on this show and follow what's going on. We'll be eager to see what the Supreme Court does. This will be a huge decision, one way or the other. The court has made some huge decisions in the past, overturning some major cases, and so maybe this is going to be one of them.
I hope so.
All right, well, we will be back in just a little bit. If you want to call in, we're going to try to take some phone calls. The number is 866-494-WVNN. That's 1-866-494-9866. I'm Brian Taylor, standing in for Phil Williams on Right Side Radio. Solid, conservative, and just plain right. We'll be right back after this.